What I want to do this morning, I'll set it down there. Will I pick up good enough down there? Okay. What I want to do this morning is actually to borrow somebody else's slides and to present some of that information to you. You know, if you've never known that, preachers do that quite often, actually. They do that, and especially when someone else has put something together that's very good, and especially something that maybe that you have studied. We had come to Richmond, a member by the name of David Aiken. He preaches for the church in Frankfort, but that's not really his main profession. His main profession is he is a professor of biological sciences in Eastern Kentucky University. And about every 5 or so years, we've decided that what we wanted to do was to have someone come and present some of the issues related to creation and evolution and evidences and things of that nature, if for no other reason than for our young people that are coming up and that are faced with that on a daily basis. We don't know where our young people are going to go to college. We would like for them to go to colleges where they're going to get a balanced approach to science and to that particular study. But oftentimes that, you know, for one reason or the other, just doesn't work out. That's just not going to be possible. And so they have to end up, and they have to go to secular universities. And when you go to a secular university, you're going to be taught a very definite one side of an explanation of the evidence that we have in reference to life, in reference to how it all began, in reference to the purpose. And so we decided that what we wanted to do was periodically, as a new group of our youngsters got to that age of teenager, that we would bring someone in and we'd talk a little bit about, have them talk a little bit about the issues of creation and evolution. It has become even more prevalent in the intelligent design controversy, especially with the Kansas School Board attempting to introduce that as a viable alternative and a viable explanation to how life began. And so, needless to say, it has been a hot button topic, if you will. I'd venture to say that our approach to this and our belief in this even goes further than just where we believe life began. It even goes to the point of how we value life today. I mean, the current hot button topic in Missouri that's coming up on the election is going to be the stem cell research question. And it is interesting that as you look at the individuals on either side of that question, those that are on one side predominantly have the idea that life is just something that has evolved. It is something that is just a very humanistic kind of standpoint. And so there's really no moral ramifications to doing some of the things that are being suggested. Those on the other side of that question say, well, it is a moral and an ethical question, and we don't need to be tampering with what God has established. And so I'm not here to argue that thing one way or the other. I'm just here to show you that when we start talking about where did life come from, that it opens up a whole new area of issues that may come in, and it determines how I look at those issues. If I believe that we are just continually evolving, then who am I to stand in the way of the evolutionary process of standing against what research that might be done that might help the quality of individuals' life? Who am I to do that? But if I am a created being and I'm going to give an account for what I do, then it makes me step back and say, well, what are the moral implications in this particular question? And so that's why I believe that when we talk about creation and evolution and all these various things, we need to understand that there's ramifications beyond just whether we figure out where we came from and how we managed to get here. And so I want to present some of the slides, maybe. My computer's been kind of acting weird today. I need to do this. What I want to suggest to you this morning is that there are three basic things that in reference to this issue, and I really appreciated Brother Aiken bringing this out because I think this is so important for us to remember, and if we don't get anything else, people need to understand these three things. Number one, when we talk about evolution, we need to be, and we should never ever say evolution without qualifying that with something. Because whether or not you realize that or not, if I were to ask you, are you an evolutionist or a creationist? If you said creationist, I would say, no, you're not. And if you were to say, well, I'm an evolutionist, obviously I would say, no, you're not. Because the correct answer to that is, yes, I'm both. Because it depends upon what evolution you're talking about. If you're talking about general evolution, then, well, no, I'm not an evolutionist if that's what you're talking about. If you're talking about special evolution, then, well, yes, I am that. I believe that. And that was one of the things that Darwin actually did get right. We need to understand that there is a difference between the general theory of evolution and the special theory of evolution. And whether or not you realize it or not, you do believe in one of those. We see it all the time. You do believe in one of those and not the other. The second thing is, and this is very important for our young people, they need to recognize where the evidence stopped and the interpretation began. When you look in science books, it's getting to where it's not as clear. I took a general sciences course here about 6 months ago. And in that course, there was biology, there was physical science, and there was natural science. And when you look at some of the textbooks, it's interesting to read, especially my biology book, as you read through that, it was really interesting to see where they separated the evidence from the interpretation. Here is the evidence, but then they gave their interpretation, but their interpretation, they spun it as if it was the evidence. And so they make such strong cases, and in fact there are statements, they'll make statements like, well, any competent scientist. Well, if you're going to stand up and question it, what does that immediately make you? Incompetent. Because no competent scientist is going to question these things. And so they make such dogmatic statements like that, that gives the student, or the college student, or the high school student, the impression that there is an overwhelming case supporting the general theory of evolution. When in essence, it's just the interpretation that they are really blustering about, and the evidence may or may not be there. The third thing that we need to recognize, and we're going to talk more in depth about each one of these, so if you're scratching your head, don't worry, we're going to talk more in depth about each one of these. Students must recognize that wherever you fall in the debate, I don't care. Well, I do care, but for this point, I don't care. I don't care wherever you fall. Guess what? It's going to be a matter of faith. Because here's the problem. Not any of us was there in the beginning of time. Not a one of us was there. So since none of us was there, then it's going to be by faith I take a stand on how I think it got started. In fact, I believe that's what the Hebrew writer said, wasn't it? Faith is the evidence of things not seen. I wasn't there. I didn't witness that. So if I believe it on faith, I believe it on the basis of evidence, not on the basis of sight. And the second thing that even the general theory of evolution proponents have to acknowledge is that if you can't reproduce it, then you can't prove it. You have to believe it by faith. If I think that this drug is going to do do good. Then one of the things that we do is we test it on rats. And if it helps rats, then the next thing we do is we take it to a clinical study of maybe 50 people. And if it doesn't do anything to those 50 people, then we broaden that clinical study to 500 people. And if it doesn't do anything to those individuals, adverse side effects, and it helps the things that we want it to help, then scientists come to the conclusion that, well, we have done it in rats, we've done it in this limited study and this broader study. Now we believe it is acceptable for the population to use this drug. It does do the things that we need it to do. It helps in the areas in which we need it to help. And it doesn't cause any adverse side effects. And so as a result of that, we have tested it, and we think that it's okay. Well, there's no way to test how the world got started. And so wherever you stand on it, you're going to have to be aware of the fact, and you know, we don't have trouble acknowledging this, but a scientist really struggles with this, that you are believing what you believe because that's your faith. Your faith says that the best explanation for the evidence is the general theory of evolution. Other people's faith says their explanation of the evidence is that there's an intelligent designer, there's a supernatural being that created all this. But neither one of us was there. So we're all in the same boat when it comes to trying to figure out how this world began. And this is how those who believe in the general theory of evolution, they mock those, say, well, you've got a blind faith. Well, you know what? Our faith is every bit as blind, if you will, as theirs. I mean, we're all in the same boat on this because none of us was there. So we had to figure out then how we approach this. I want to suggest to you, as we talk about, back that up. Hey, I can do that. As we talk about the difference between what is the evidence and what is the interpretation of the evidence. Now, you may not understand everything in this quote, but I want you to try to see where there is the evidence and where there is the interpretation. Inferences about common descent derived from paleontology have been reinforced by comparative anatomy. The skeletons of humans, dogs, quails, and bats are strikingly similar. Now, if you put all of those up there, if I had pictures of all of the skeletons of all these animals, guess what? They are strikingly similar. The structures are a lot the same. They compare very nicely. Skeletons, humans, dogs, well said, despite the different ways of life led by these animals and the diversity of environments in which they have flourished, the correspondence bone by bone can be observed in every part of the body, including the limbs. Yet a person writes, a dog runs, a whale swims, and a bat flies. The structure is built of the same bones. Scientists call such structures homologous and have concurred that they are best explained by common descent. Now, since I stopped there, that's kind of a dead giveaway that evidently something changed. You see the change? There's no denying the fact that when you throw skeletons of a bat and a whale and a man, there are some differences, but there are a ton of similarities. There are a ton of biological similarities that we share with animals. Scientists explain the evidence. Now, the evidence is biological similarities. Scientists look at that and say, aha, we know why that is. That's because we all came from the same thing. It's the amoeba. Did I have that up there? Nope, I didn't. Losing control here. I really didn't want to do that. There we go. No, I didn't want to do that. It's the amoeba to man idea. That we all these branches of humanity, I've got that slide in there somewhere. I keep rearranging them, trying to make it logical, and I keep changing my mind. All these branches all came from the amoeba. We all, you know, amoeba to man kind of idea. Well, that's how scientists look at it. Now, what's the evidence? Well, the evidence is that as we look at skeletons, they are strikingly similar. The scientists look to that and say, well, our explanation is they're similar because we all came from the same thing. What would be another alternative explanation? Another alternative explanation in my mind might be, you know, it could be that a designer used the same pattern and created different things. Wouldn't that be a logical alternative explanation? How many times have engineers used the same design, but in this application they changed this or switched this, but it's basically the same design? We're going to build a bridge, but this bridge needs to span this long. So we're going to use the same design, but change this and modify this a little bit so that it will take care of this. We're going to build a bridge over running water. Well, we've got a little more things to consider. The span shouldn't be as long. It's basically the same design, but we modify it a little bit. But if you were to compare all of them together from an engineering standpoint, they'd all look the same. There would be, well, I shouldn't say the same. There would be striking similarities. And so if that's the case, then scientists may have come along and said, well, we think the explanation for all of the biological similarities is the fact that we all came from one. Now, you have to at least acknowledge if there is an alternative view, and if it is logical, then it should hold as much weight as the other side. And that's all that those who have argued the intelligent design, they have never argued for removing, or most of the ones that I've read about, have never argued for removing evolution from the classroom, though ultimately they would probably like that done. They've never taken that stand. They've said, just teach it as another explanation to the evidence. In fact, when you get that, isn't that really what science is supposed to be about? An objective look at what are all the explanations for the evidence that we have before us. And so we have to be aware of the fact that as we read some of these things, and as our kids begin to read some of these things, they have to be able to separate what truly is the evidence from what is the interpretation of the evidence. When you think about evidence, Brother Aiken made this comment, I remember him saying, evidence is evidence is evidence is evidence. It doesn't belong to anybody. It doesn't belong to anybody. When you have a trial, and here is Joe Blow, and the prosecuting attorney says, Joe Blow did this heinous act. The defense attorney says, no, my client Joe Blow did not do that act. And the prosecuting attorney is going to take the evidence and do what? Say, well, based on this evidence, I think it clearly shows Joe Blow did it. The defense attorney is going to do what? Take different evidence? No. He's going to take the same evidence and say, well, based upon this evidence, I believe he didn't do it. What it is, we have evidence, but there are different ways to interpret that. And so scientists come along and say, well, the evidence is we've got biological similarity. That obviously means that we all came from the same being. If you allow me to say creationists, they come along and they say, no, we have evidence of biological similarities that indicates to us same pattern used by one designer. Well, that's as logical an explanation as anything. And so we have to recognize that when we talk about, well, the evidence points this way. You know, evidence really doesn't point. Evidence is just evidence. And we have to figure out, based upon the evidence, how should we go? As you read in the Bible, Romans chapter 1 and Psalm chapter 19, the Lord has given us plenty of evidence to suggest to us that when we look at the heavens and when we look at the creation and we look at all these things, we see the invisible attributes of God. Now what does that tell me? That tells me that God didn't leave us down here to wonder, where's our evidence that we can use? We use the same evidence a scientist uses. And God has left that even for the scientist. That was given even for the scientist. The evidence that the scientist is using, when you think about it, is actually evidence that God left of him. We can't help but if men take that and say, well, we're going to take God out of his creation. God left that evidence to point us toward him. Evidence doesn't support theories. Evidence or theories are developed to explain the evidence. Well, we've got this, now what do we do with it? How do we explain this? And so the issue is not really scientific fact versus religious fact. The issue is not the Bible versus Darwin. The issue is which position of faith is more reasonable based on your interpretation of the facts, which is more reasonable. And that's all that we're asking for. Probably we need to be madder at this fellow than we need to be mad at Darwin. Because actually what motivated Darwin was Carolus Linnaeus and his idea, and this was what the Roman Catholic Church thought at the time of Darwin. They thought that species are immutable. Now, what does that mean? Well, we know immutable, and if you've got the King James Version, you run into that word in James chapter 1, where in the book of Hebrews, where it talks about God being immutable. And what that means is God doesn't change. And so what was the prevailing attitude of the church, and I mean by the Roman Catholic Church, what was the prevailing attitude of the Roman Catholic Church during the time of Darwin was that God created species day one. They've not changed a bit. Species are immutable. Species are unchangeable. They're exactly as they were from the time that God created them. And Darwin, here's an example of that. I don't have my laser pointer. On the right is a chart demonstrating that here's the creation date. The rhino is exactly as it was from the day that God created it. Darwin looked at it and said, well, you know, I see a lot of variations and changes, so species aren't immutable, aren't unchangeable. There's a misconception about those of us who believe in creation, that we think this, that we think that God created every animal is exactly as it is now, and it's never changed, and however old the earth is, it's never changed. Well, there isn't any evidence for that. You can't support that. The creationist hypothesis implies that all living things should be traceable through a series of unchanged fossil ancestors back to the creation date. No new form should appear after the date of creation, nor should any present-day organisms exhibit significant differences from the fossil ancestors. That's from the American biology teacher. Well, they got it wrong. You know, that's a typical case of, here's what they believe, and then we just knock the tar out of that belief. You know, it's creating a straw man. And say, well, I can't believe they believe that. Well, they're so illogical and irrational, and so we just knock the tar out of that straw man, and then you meet somebody that's a creationist, so I hear you believe, I don't believe that. I hear new people don't believe in music. And I look at people like, I don't know where you got that from. I don't believe that. I hear you people believe water saves you. No, I don't know where you got that. See, they build a straw man and then create their case and knock the stuffing out of him. And there, that proves my case. No, it just proves that you created a straw man that nobody believes and knocked the stuffing out of him. It doesn't really support your case any. And that's what has gone on here. You know, if you can't deal with the arguments, then you just create a misconception and then just knock the snot out of it, and that makes your side look better. That's not really being very honest with the facts. So let's talk a little bit about what is the difference between the general theory of evolution and the special theory of evolution. I want you to notice G.A. Kerckhut, you may not be able to see that very well. G.A. Kerckhut was a scientist. And he was a well-known, very well-respected proponent of general evolution. So when we start talking about general evolution and special evolution and making a distinction, you don't need to make those distinctions and be ashamed, because they can't look at you and say, oh, well, you're creationist. You've just made that distinction. No one thinks that. Here is a general theory of evolution proponent making the distinction. In his book, Implications of Evolution, he said, on the other hand, there's a theory that all the living forms in the world have arisen from a single source, which itself came from an inorganic form. This can be called the general theory of evolution. I knew I had that chart in there somewhere. There's the general theory of evolution. All life came from a single source. And that sprang from something else. And so all of this has sprang. This is the amoeba to man kind of idea. And you see, we've got all life has branched off from this amoeba into all these variations of life that we have now. How do they support that? For some of you, this may be a stretch, but try to remember back when you had biology, either in high school or in college. And when they would talk about evolution, one of the charts, and I remember seeing this, one of the charts that I remember seeing was the evolution of what? The horse. And you see how the evolution has changed, you see the change in the horse, and you see all how that he was small, and how that he had this kind of hoof, and he had these kind of bones, and now he doesn't have that, and that's like this. You see, evolution is true. The general theory of evolution is right. But the question to ask is, what do you have at the bottom of that chart? You have a horse. Small, but you still have a horse. What do you have at the top of the chart? You have a horse. Big, but it's still a horse. So we started with the horse. The horse got a little bigger. The horse got a little bigger. The horse got a few stripes. The horse got bigger. What do we still have? We still have a horse. What they really demonstrate is the special theory of evolution. Change within a species. Change within, the Bible calls it, change within a kind. You don't have a frog at the bottom of that. You don't have a fish at the bottom of that. You have a horse that has changed the various ages of time. I believe, most likely, adapting to its environment. And as a result of that, you have a horse, a horse, a horse, a horse, and a horse. The special theory of evolution. But what they do is they say, now I want you to look. Look at all of these evolutionary changes. You see, there it is. The general theory of evolution support. It doesn't support that. It supports changes in a horse, not changes of kind, changes within a kind. We didn't go from one kind to another kind. We're still within the same kind. There's a special theory that states that, again, G.A. Caricat's book, Implications of Evolution. There's a theory which states that many living animals and plants, now that's been added by Bacon, can be observed over the course of time to undergo changes so that new species are formed. This can be called the special theory of evolution and can be demonstrated in certain cases by experiment. One of the things, and I just realized I forgot to stick that in here, the peppered moth experiment that they did, where you had, because of the Industrial Revolution, many of the trees where the peppered moth lived, there used to be a predominantly white moth. But because of the Industrial Revolution several years ago, the trees around the area of factories, they were putting out soot and black smoke. And as a result of that, it turned the trees from a white kind of aspen-looking tree to black. Well, there were peppered moths that were white and peppered moths that were black. Not very many black ones because they kind of stood out like a sore thumb, but there were a few. It was at least in their DNA. When the trees changed and the trees began to be black, the white peppered moths, guess what? They stood out like a sore thumb. And the birds found them and the birds ate them. And the ratio of peppered moths, white to peppered moths, black, began to change. Because you see, the black ones now weren't getting eaten as often. And the white ones were getting eaten a ton, and it totally changed. Brother Aiken told the story of a man who had went back to his home where he used to hunt quail. And he said, there's always quail. We would love to run them, or to spook them up. And they'd go to this field, and they'd spook them up. They realized they hunt quail. They really didn't hunt quail. They just liked to go and spook them up. Well, hunters figured out that this is where they were. And so they started allowing hunting on this particular ground. And when they would spook them up, guess what? They'd get shot.
Now, he says, we could hear some quail running, but it was the ones that would fly were the ones that we were interested in. And they were predominant. But when hunters came in and started shooting the flyers, guess how the population changed? Well, the flyers got fewer and fewer because they were getting shot, and the runners got more and more because they were staying hid, not being scared up and getting shot. That's what Darwin called natural selection. Changes in the environment causes creations to, or causes the living organisms in that area to adapt and to change. Now, the one thing that you don't see a white peppered moth that was born white turning black.